Cassie was admitted in 1995 and came to the bar in 2000. In those intervening 5 years, she worked with the Australian Council of Trade Unions as an advocate. She then was an advocate, industrial officer and Victorian branch solicitor with the Media, Entertainment and Arts Alliance, and then went to the Federal Court to be the associate of Mr Justice Shane Marshall. In the last 11 years at the bar, Cassie's developed a practice which has her in court regularly in industrial relations, employment law, discrimination and personal injuries matters, and it has her appearing in a range of tribunals and across all of the courts. Throughout this period, Cassie has developed a special interest in advocacy and the teaching of advocacy, and that has led to her regularly presenting on the topic, Leo Cusson, other places as well, I figured Cassie has told me, but and she's very kindly consented to come this morning and provide this presentation for us, and for your sake with CPD, it comes under the heading of professional skills. Cassie Serpell.
Thank you, Michael. Thank you very much. Good morning. You're doing well. It's dark out there, at least it was when I walked in. It's wet. It's early. And this workshop also is something I'm reminding of. It's a workshop. It's not me talking to you for the next however long Michael has said until he says stop. It is a workshop, and I have this fixed microphone and I have this roaming microphone, and I'm warning you now, because this topic involves you being quite active. Those of you who are here because you actually are interested in advocacy as opposed to just wanting to get the points, you never know when you're going to need it. You're going to be called on at some point in time. If you haven't already, I'm sure most of you have been around the block a couple of times in legal sense and been called upon to get onto your feet and to show what you can do in terms of... It is quite challenging. One of the most challenging things that people face in the top seven for the things people most fear doing, public speaking, and to get a grip on that, if you participate rather than inactively sitting there, and I'll try and nudge you along with this roaming microphone, you'll get a lot more out of it. So, I really do enjoy it. Michael wasn't joking when he said I'd developed a special interest in this area. I think it's a very good area. If you never think you're going to use it, it's great to have up your sleeve so you can be more relaxed. It'll help you in other settings. It's great for your confidence once you break through the butterflies and other barriers. And there may be many of you who are quite commonly on your feet already. You may get something out of this in any event. I hope you do. So you'll find a paper, which isn't really a paper for your reading as we go through. It's really a list of headings designed to have a bit of space around them so you can jot in bits and pieces that somehow resonate with you. So the first you can see of those headings is what qualities does a good advocate have? And this is where I start to throw to you, right at the get-go. So with that question, what qualities does a good advocate have, I'm not looking for one particular answer, but there's many. I'll just check, yeah, this does work. So I'm going to move around now and I'm going to go to my first new friend in the room. Barry is going to tell me at least one or two qualities he thinks a good advocate might have.
I think a very important attribute is to be a good listener.
Can you hear up the back?
No.
Give it another go.
I think one of the important aspects of an advocate is to be a good listener, to understand what you're dealing with, who you're dealing with, and then understand the issues. There are a whole list of things, but I think being a good listener is a good start.
That's a brilliant start. And as we get to cross-examination and examination in chief, you'll see just how important being a good listener is. Now I'm going to ask Andrew what qualities he thinks, or quality he's going to select, he thinks a good advocate might have.
Integrity.
Integrity? Do you want to elucidate?
Not particularly, but other than to say that it's important to mislead.
I don't know if this is picking up because of the microphone. I wasn't wanting to push too far into Andrew's face, but talking about not misleading the court, very, very important to be aware of your ethical obligations. Apart from that, you want to have integrity, obviously, in your dealings with your client, even dealings with your the other side. I say even because some people think that you're better off putting the other side at a distance and arm's length and treating them with some disdain because perhaps your client might like that. That's not my, been my experience, nor my practice, I would hope. I think if you act with professionalism, your client will understand. If you develop a rapport with people you frequently sometimes see on the other side. Let's look for another quality. AJ, have you got one there?
Be yourself as much as you can.
Fantastic. Be yourself as much as you can was that response. There's no point in trying to be somebody else or trying to put on somebody else's characteristics. If you develop the qualities that are best in yourself, you're going to be much more natural, much more comfortable. And you might even get to really develop and come a lot closer with those qualities in yourself that allow you to really shine. Moving along here, those are the well, I'm going to move to the other side of the aisle as well. Nicola?
I think it's really important that whoever you're cross-examining or speaking to, you speak at their level so they understand the questions you're putting to them.
Terrific. Simplicity. We'll come back to this in a little bit. There's no point in using terms or concepts, in my view, that are difficult to understand. And so it's not that you're talking down, but you want to be understood. If you can't be understood, you're wasting your breath and your time, and your client's case is not being best presented. Thank you. Peter?
I think you need to be a clear thinker, an organised thinker.
That's always a terrific asset. You're doing all very well. It might be the coffee here so far, this time of morning. But being organised doesn't just help your case, it helps your stress levels. It means you find things quickly. You look like you know what you're doing. There's so many benefits. Thank you. I'm going to go across here now.
Deborah?
Clear speaking. Important, important. If you can't be heard, you can't be understood, all those beautiful submissions or questions that you have lined up are going straight down the toilet. They need to get where? Where do your words go, importantly?
To the court, to the tribunal.
Yeah, that's one place. And if you are watching that tribunal member closely, which I encourage you to do, then you'll be working out, as you do in normal conversation, if you think it's understood, whether it's been received well. So you're looking for, as I've had here, as I turn around and speak to you back of the room, a few nods here and there, you're looking for some sort of recognition. You might see now the pen starts moving in the judge's book. These sorts of things to help you indicate or help indicate to you that your message is being received. It may not be going down well, but you can usually tell about that as well. But you're looking for, as I see in the man with the blue shirt, a bit of a nod, he's awake, I know that. Another one?
Confidence.
Fantastic. Confidence, really, really important. And if you aren't feeling confident, you still want to give the appearance of feeling confident. Until you get there, hopefully that comes in time. Sometimes you have a case or a client that makes it a little more difficult to be confident. You don't always get the world's best case. But confidence is critical to being an effective advocate. Thank you. Mark?
Having the structure and being succinct.
Structure and being succinct. Beautiful. I'll leave it back to that.
Chrissy? Hi. Knowing what you need to know, knowing the case, knowing the client.
Fantastic. Preparation, in other words. Yeah. And what you put in, you'll get back hopefully in spades in a good way. Very hard to be confident if you aren't prepared. Very hard to be confident if you can't be heard. All these other things, that all tie in. Moving down the room. This is Tom.
Engaging with your audience.
Absolutely. Body language is good for that. Gestures, the way you speak, light and shade, all these things. We'll come back and talk more about that as well. Sam?
I was going to say, Mark said, I think
ensuring that one premise follows another and you deliver an argument that makes sense rather than scattered.
Yes, so an argument makes sense rather than scattered is always an asset. And at the back of the room now?
The ability to know to stop talking.
Mm. Okay, I'll go back to the top. Okay, so the ability to know when to stop talking ties into the one question too many in cross-examination, which we'll get to in a bit. So, I might just move this one a bit further forward. Does that sound a bit better? Can you hear me up the back okay? Yep, good. So there's one word that would allow all those others that we've just discussed to sit within them. What is it that you're trying to do as an advocate? It begins with P. Persuade, that's right. And everything is about persuasion. You're angling and working everything in order to persuade as to your submissions, that your case is the one and the view that needs to be aligned with your case is the one that you want the tribunal, the decision maker, to accept. And everything works to that, everything. It's your touchstone. Is this persuading, and what is it persuading about? It needs to be the very nub of your case. So, how do we persuade? There's lots and lots of ways. I'm going to adjust this microphone, so if it makes a few noises, don't worry. I'm also in a band, so I feel reasonably confident about moving this microphone without hurting it too much. So in persuading, I want you to think about this. And in fact, I'll throw it as a question. When we are looking to persuade in court, how much percentage do you reckon attributes to what is said, as in the verbal, as opposed to the visual? Any ideas? Take a stab. Percentage terms. Barry? 75% for verbal? Yeah, okay. Anybody else got any ideas?
Less than half.
Less than half, says Michael Green. Anybody else? One more before I let you know. 30. 30 for verbal. Much closer. It's about 86 visual. It's massive. Visual is massive. It's what people do all the time, watch television, watch people, taking everything in. And when you strip away the visual, what do you glean from the telephone? It's very limited, isn't it? Versus even if you're not hearing somebody but you can watch them in the room. You get a sense of their gestures, the way they hold themselves, how they're interacting with others, what they're actually doing. And so don't forget the visual is what I'm emphasising here. It's really, really important. Very important what you say and how you say it, of course. And that's not just cream on top. It's very, very critical, of course. Otherwise, we wouldn't prepare submissions. We wouldn't actually think about the questions we were going to ask. We'd just make a few gestures and nod our head and perhaps smile or grimace occasionally. But the visual is so critical. So do get to be, when we talked about earlier, being yourself. You're being yourself, tapping into the qualities that you like. Hopefully not tapping into the qualities that are distracting. Distractions are not assisting your case. They're not helping you to persuade. So when I teach this subject, when I give workshops in this subject at Leo Cussons and elsewhere for students and practitioners, there's a lot of on your feet, have a go, and I see, and others will see in the class, what sort of mannerisms are really working for you, what sort of gestures and other things are assisting that, and there might be occasionally some sort of mannerism, some sort of behaviour that's a bit distracting. One that I find distracting in court when I am opposed to someone else, in this instance with this particular distracting thing, it's generally a bloke, and it's with money in the pocket, jingling, standing there asking questions, whether it's in chief or cross, and hand in the pocket, jingling the change in the pocket. It's distracting. Some gestures really assist. My old mentor used to pull his glasses off and gesture with his glasses. Now, with his particular looks, his demeanour, his age, it worked wonderfully. Made him look very learned indeed. I don't do it the same. He's very good at it. So it's about, as I say, emphasising the gestures that work for you and the mannerisms and all the rest, and having a critical look at how you appear. A great way to do that is to just stand in front of the mirror. It gets easier as you go along. Some people might love it anyway, I don't know. But playing back your own voice, listening to how you sound, most people hate that at first, but hearing if there's what? Light and shade. You don't want that sing-song rhythm. It's going to drive somebody either crazy or put them to sleep. Again, you don't want your tribunal member, you don't want your judge, you don't want the bench to go to sleep for obvious reasons, unless you've got such a bad case you think it might be the best strategy. Not usually, one would hope. So in terms of the visual versus the verbal, remember massive, massive, massive. If you're writing this down, put big asterisks there. How many of the people who are now in the room, we're still filling up, I think, have actually been on their feet at least once? Can I show of hands? Yeah, as I had suspected, most of you. How many have done it more than 10 times? Okay, about half. And who does it regularly? Yep, okay, maybe about 8. So what you do in court really and what you can bring to it with a bit of thought and practice and a bit of focus, hopefully you get a lot more out of your time after today's session. But you'll already, those who are frequently appearing in court, already have a fairly good sense, one would hope, of the etiquette. Most of us would know that when you are entering the court, if the judge or judges or the bench are sitting, then you give a little bow, that you turn off your mobile phone, that you don't put your bag on the bar table, that you don't chew, that you don't pull out a newspaper, that you don't talk when it's not your turn, all these sorts of things, the etiquette. How to refer to the tribunal. Is it president? Is it commissioner? Is it your honour? Is it, as some clients often say, your excellency? Oops. As I tell people, if you don't know, find out before you go. And if you haven't had time, well, generally you can fall back on sir or madam, but as long as you're getting the gender right, you should be all right there. Important, so important to know who it is that you're going to appear before. If you don't know that, you already got your eyes closed in some way. Why is that important? Look, it's obvious to probably most of you, but it doesn't hurt to expand a little on this. If you know who it is, you know how to tailor your argument. You know already a bit about how to pitch it. Because what are we trying to do? We're trying to persuade. It's much easier to know a bit about the person you're trying to persuade before you try to do that. You might otherwise come a cropper, say something that's going to really sit badly in their ears, and that's not what you want to do. Last week, I was in a magistrate's court for a friend's daughter, and I was before somebody I didn't know. Okay, so I'm standing in the line at the magistrate's court, making my getting my appearance noted. From there, I asked who it was in that particular court. When I heard the name and didn't recognise it, I had a look in the queue behind me and I saw somebody that looked like they might be a regular practitioner. I asked them if they knew this particular fella. They said they did. They gave me a brief rundown, a very helpful rundown, and so I was already halfway there. What did I do then? I then went into the court, tried to get a sense of when I was likely to come on, made myself known to the associate. Doesn't hurt, all this thing. You get yourself into a position of being able to find out as much as he can as soon as possible. Sat in there for 2 hours before we came on. I was happy for that. My client also needed to see a little bit about how these criminal matters work and needed to get a sense of stuff. So in the meantime, observing, seeing the other cases go through and seeing how accurate the description I've been given of this particular magistrate was. Very, very helpful. So by the time I'm on my feet, I already feel like this is somebody I know quite well and I have a good sense of what sort of comments are likely to go down poorly and what sort of comments are going to go down well. I tailor my argument accordingly and hopefully assists the result, certainly a happy result in that instance. But it's just about arming yourself. Now, if there was nobody there to talk to, I'd make a call. Michael's always a very knowledgeable man. He'll know if he doesn't know the person himself who to speak to find out. I would generally have a reasonable sense of who I think in that field is going to know enough to tell me. And forearmed is forewarned. If you go in blindly, well, you get what you get. It's worth the extra effort, really worth the extra effort. And it's not just knowing a bit about their background. You want to know what they're like, what they do, what they don't like in terms of whether they're somebody who wants to draw their own conclusions, whether they want to be fed information, whether all sorts of things. Okay, so knowing your judge or your tribunal, incredibly important. And we spoke earlier about preparation. How many people have got had to be on their feet when they've been given almost no notice, maybe 5-10 minutes notice and the next thing? Yep, a couple of hands there. Yep, a few more hands when you think about it and wake up. The coffee's taking a little bit of time to sink in and kick in, I think. So preparation is, in an ideal world, you spend a lot of time, you're very organised, your brief is looking like it's been perfectly designed for the way you want to approach the case. But in the event that you can't have that, what do you do? Well, one thing you might do is have a good chat to your client, as good as your time will permit. You, with the information you got, you try and be selective about what you refer to. Might be you have a chat with the person on the other side. Depends what's at your, the nearest resource that's going to get you in the best place as soon as possible. And then you need to think about whether you need an adjournment, all sorts of things that are going to assist you in buying some time to become more familiar with the case. Should you simply bowl up there and allow everything to happen without even seeking to improve your knowledge of the matter and not letting anybody know that you've just been thrown in the deep end here in terms of the facts and the situation that you're being asked to deal with, well, I would highly recommend seeking to take the control to put you in a much better position before being thrown in. Sometimes, with all of that, you still don't get the opportunity. You may have a judge or tribunal member who simply say, that's too bad, I want to know about this, and otherwise if you don't tell me now, well, your case is going to go out the window. And you just do the best you can. It takes a lot of courage sometimes being an advocate. Confidence, courage, hopefully not foolhardiness, because a lot of it is also about control, taking control, trying to develop in yourself that unflappability. Really, really important. If you've got it naturally, fantastic. If you don't, very important to try and develop as soon as possible. The last thing your client wants to see is you looking flustered and out of control. They don't want to hear you using the high voice because you're agitated. They want calm. They want measure. They want strength, generally speaking. These qualities, as I say, if you haven't got them naturally or you're not feeling them naturally at that time, you still want to give that appearance. So preparation, we're down at here, organisation, whatever system works for you, that's what I say. You might get a brief if you're acting as an advocate. You might prepare the brief yourself if you are representing your client directly. you rearrange it or arrange it in a way that's going to work for you, a way that you know is going to best assist you. You have, if, for example, it's a case involving medical reports, you know exactly where they are, apart from the fact of going through them many times and working up your questions. You're going to be familiar with it to the best of your ability. You're going to know the facts as well as you can. If you know the facts as well as you can answer questions from the bench a lot more easily, obviously. Knowing the law is obviously a big help as well. Sometimes I think if you had a choice between the facts or the law, you're probably better off knowing the facts really well. You can often get to the law later, but if you don't know your facts, the rest is not very relevant. It doesn't have much to attach to, does it? But in, as I say, an ideal world, you'd be across all the relevant law, all the relevant facts, and know what the important issues are for the court's determination. We talked earlier about being heard and being understood. So even if the people up the back could hear noise but couldn't really decipher what I was saying, it'd be a waste of time attending really today, wouldn't it? So being understood, being heard, how do you check that? I said before about body language, watching for pen, watching for the little nods, these sorts of things. Gestures, body language are also important in terms of your witnesses, which include your client if they are a witness in their own case. So what do you do with the body language? What is good, what is bad? When I have a client come in to see me just before a hearing is about to commence, it might be as likely to start the next day or next few days, I talk to them, I observe them as I ask some questions and take them through the matters I think they're likely to be taken to in evidence and cross-examination. And I watch them closely, I listen to them closely, and if there are gestures, if there are body language issues that I think are too distracting or give a wrong impression. Had a fellow earlier this week in a trial, quite a large fellow with many injuries, and he had his arms folded and rested on his large belly. Now, in general observation, most people would probably understand that looks quite defensive and it's not open, and you want your witnesses to be well received by the court, to look as if they're being open and honest and dignified and fair and reasonable. And this isn't generally a good one, but for him he said, look, that's the way I sit, it's much more comfortable for me. He actually found it a bit supportive in terms of his injuries, and so I wasn't about to tell him, knowing that he might have to sit in a chair mostly for in excess of a day in court, that he couldn't do that because he'd probably forget about that and go back to it anyway. So it's better then to explain to the court. It might be that your client is somebody who culturally looks down and doesn't look you in the eye. If you've got something like that, it's better to explain it to the court. So at the outset, I explain these things to the court. It might be, as I had the wife of a witness, a wife of a client, in a matter late last year. She had a lung issue. One of her lungs actually was barely working, so she was able to only speak in a bit of a whisper. All these things can be accommodated and placed if you explain them to the court. You don't want the wrong impression being gained about these things. You don't want the court to think, well, somebody's not telling the truth because of this, or someone's being closed because of this, or somebody doesn't think this is important. So the impression you give, think about that in terms of being on your feet, but also think about it in terms of your witnesses. Does it look better to be seated as Andrew is here, upright with his arms in front? I won't give an example of anybody I think isn't looking good sitting in their seat here, but if you're slouching, got your arms folded and not looking in the right direction in terms of where the question's coming from or the judge, you're not really conveying an impression of wanting to be there, and it might be that the impression you give is a very negative one. So think about that for your witnesses as well. How are we going for the time, Michael? What time do you want to break? Another five? Okay. So, I spoke about light and shade. You've been listening to my voice now for quite a while and a few of your own. Light and shade is really important. And I said not having that la 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 sing-song quality, very, very important. Some of you have had your first cup of coffee. Shortly you might get a second. But on the bench, and jury members don't necessarily have that ready access. They're not generally allowed to bring Red Bull or some of the other products into to court. So it gets a bit hard. Sometimes it's airless in court. Sometimes it's hot. Sometimes people have been up half the night because they're concerned about the case or they've just been very busy in their lives. So try and make it easy for them with the sound of your voice, with the way you speak, with the gestures that you use, with the words that you choose, all of these things. Projecting. I have the luxury today of a microphone, but in court the microphones aren't actually amplifying in the ordinary course. They are simply there for transcribing purposes. They're recording. You need to tell your witness that as well, your witnesses. It might be that they keep talking into the microphone really loudly. All of this you need to adjust, and you need to adjust it for yourself as well. You can hear yourself, but it's hard to know exactly what somebody else is hearing, and an easy way to do that is, as I did at the start of this session, was ask if those people up the back could actually hear, and when I took around the roaming mic as well. These all the things that I'm telling you seem very common sense when you think about them, I'm sure. But when you're on your feet for the first few times, I think most of you probably would remember, as I do, when we used to watch television in the old days before you had television 24/7. And at the end of the evening, you get the test pattern, and then you get that shh white noise. And a lot of times when people get on their feet, they've got a lot of preparation and they get up and they're so anxious and all they can hear in their head and see is that shh white noise. That anxiety can be incredibly debilitating. And so the things that I'm referring you to and the things that I'll come back and expand on later after you've had a chance to have a bit more to eat and something else to drink are all designed to help you get through that a lot more easily for those of you experiencing that still. So, yes, maybe now, Michael. Is that good? Yep. We'll take a little break and we'll come back and wrap up later.